Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Uniting Melba and podcast through the Toorak Times. It's always a pleasure to bring you, through their stories, the life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. This is a special Baby Boomers edition. Welcome to part two of a three-part program on 65-year-old Lindsay Field. I'm Rob Greaves, and in part one, we learned that Lindsay was born in Wellington, New Zealand in 1950. His father was a senior officer in the New Zealand Air Force, and the young Lindsay experienced life living overseas from a young age. But most of his story still takes place in New Zealand until he gets older. In this part of his story, we learn of his time in a boarding school, which he wanted badly to go to, but it didn't quite turn out the way that he thought it would. It was at boarding school when he first experienced an attack of Bell's palsy, which would not be the last time that he was so afflicted. As a young boy, this was a very frightening experience. One of the great things that happened during his education years was his exposure to music, which in itself has had a lifelong and profound influence on him. In fact, as we learn, this eventually led to Lindsay joining the smash musical Hair, which in turn led to him moving and living in Sydney. We pick up with Lindsay talking about his grandmother, who it turns out was a healer.
It's interesting that my grandmother was a local healer, and so she would go out round the Rye Valley where there were lots of Scandinavians. She was Ruby Rat, so she was Danish heritage.
I was going to ask you, yes, what your heritage was. So
on my father's side, there were the Rats and Simonsons, and on my father's side, there were Fields, of course.
Of course.
Bertie Osgood Field, and my father was Selwyn Osgood Field. And so she would go away for a week at a time, and my father was the youngest three girls, two boys in that family. And Ruby went out doing the rounds for a week, you know, splinting legs, delivering babies or whatever it was that she did. And when she came back, there was a Mrs. Hemi, who was the local matriarch of the local iwi, the tribe that was based out of the Maupoko. And he lived at Canvastown on the Pelorus River, just as it came into the Marlborough Sounds. And she said to my grandmother, she said, "Oh, we christened the boy Ruby." She said, "Oh, what did you call him?" She said, "Oh, we called him Rongo Rongo." And Rongo Rongo was actually quite a dignified name in Maori. So Dad was always called Rongo during his early years. And it wasn't until they moved to Nelson that they thought, "Oh, this is not going to go down well."
Yep.
So they changed it to Selwyn. But he always referred to himself as Rongo, okay. Rongo and Rongo. So when he joined the Scouts, and in the Scouts, you always have an honorific name.
Oh, so that was his.
And that was his, Te Rongo Rongo. So he had the Te because he was the big honcho.
So the boarding school, your father went to that boarding school?
Yeah, but he was a day boy.
Yeah. Was the experience as glamorous as you thought it was going to be?
No. In some regards, yes, it was fun being with a lot of boys, but I was always in a bit of trouble. I wasn't a troubled person, but I got into trouble. And also, I think it was pretty stressful. That was the first, when I was 13, I was in the third form. We were in a dormitory, 10 boys in a dormitory. I woke up in the morning one morning, and everybody started to laugh at me. And so I started laughing, and so they laughed even more, and I couldn't work out what they were laughing at until I turned around and looked in the mirror. And I had Bell's palsy, which is half a facial paralysis.
Yeah.
And so when I laughed, my whole face distorted into this very strange mask, and I didn't know what was going on.
No, that would have been very scary for you.
But there was no pain associated with it. It was just suddenly this strange condition. And So I went, we had the San Sanatorium, where you went, and there was a nurse and was dispatched to the doctor who prescribed penicillin shots, which I've subsequently learned were totally ineffective.
I was going to say, I wondered why they did that. Yeah.
Well, they didn't know what it was either. You know, it was,
so they didn't diagnose it at first?
Well, they diagnosed it, but they didn't know how to treat it.
How to treat it, yeah.
Well, it's still a very moot point about how to treat it, but I've subsequently had it five times in my life. You know, it's all different treatments, different things. So now, anyway.
Yeah.
That was stressful. I had that again when I was 15, puberty, same thing. But in terms of boarding school, it was good in the sense that you had the discipline of having to do your study at night. You were set down, you sat in the study hall, couldn't talk, you just did your homework.
Did you cope academically?
Yes. Yeah. It wasn't hard.
Right.
I didn't find it hard at all. In fact, it was pretty breeze. I was in the top stream class, and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the study, but I was, and probably still am, a bit lazy. It took the path of least resistance. And so when we got to the sixth form, which was the equivalent of VCE here in Victoria, we had university entrance. If you were above a particular level in your class, in my class, I knew that historically if I was in the top 70% of that class, I would be accredited with the university entrance. I wouldn't actually have to sit the exam.
Right.
Which, I don't know if the system's the same there now, but so your enter score didn't make any difference to it. It didn't happen. You were just accredited, and so instead of studying and going through the whole trauma of sitting for that external exam, we all went up into the bush to this place called Mataki Taki Lodge and, hooned around.
That was an enjoyable experience in year 12, I guess.
Yes, yes. Well, there was still another year.
After that?
Of school, yes. So you had a year called the upper sixth.
Ah.
And that was like your bursary year or a scholarship year. So if you completed that year, then you got a bursary, which wasn't very substantial, but, my university fees were $25 a year.
Oh, you're personally, you mean?
Yes. And so a bursary would have covered all of that and given you some living allowance. So, I didn't go back for that. My housemaster, who had actually been at school with my father, the first housemaster I had actually taught my father.
Wow.
And had been the housemaster for my brother, and Gunnar Johnson, his name was, Scrooge, we used to call him. And I can remember going, and he goes, "Field, eh? Another field?" I said, "Well, at least we know there's some brains in the house." but we got caned a lot. It was still coming out of the old English public school model.
Yeah.
In those days, the head prefect and the head boarding prefect both caned. So it used to shit me that I was being caned by somebody a year older than me or somebody who I played in the same rugby team with.
Yeah.
So I had a gutful of it by then. I was playing in a band. We had a band at school. We had a great music master, actually, a guy called Ralph Lilly, because we had a school that was a very musical school for a public school. It's a government school. It wasn't anything private about it. It was 300 boarders, 700 day boys. But we had a pipe organ in the assembly hall. And Ralph would teach us all by rote parts. He'd sing these parts for us because we all sat in the assembly hall, 1,000 boys, but you sat according to your vocal range.
Oh, okay.
So all of the basses are in the middle, tenors are on the side, up the...
Fantastic.
Down the front, the altos are on the side and the trebles, so the third formers, his voices hadn't broken, we're all in the very front section. And so we'd sing four-part harmony hymns.
Wow.
And it was, great experience, because everybody had their hymn books in their pockets. That was it.
Yeah.
That was it. You'd rehearse them every day.
What year is this roughly, Lindsay? Can you recall? Where are we? It must be mid to...
60, late. Early 60s. So 63 to 67.
Okay, so you're still there around 66, 67. You're still there.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, you mentioned the band. Was that a popular music band or...?
Yep, they hated us. Because up until that time, they had a dance... The school had a school dance band, but they played instrumental music.
Right.
And we were the first rock and roll band, I suppose.
Well, who did you sort of cotton onto most of that time? Because there was so much happening in Australia musically then, because we were bombarded, as probably New Zealand was, with the British beat music.
Oh, yeah. The Birds, yeah. Shapes of Things to Come. Who was that?
That was Yardbirds.
The Yardbirds. That was when I got my first fuzz box. Suddenly there was this amplified music, and you know, I can remember the headmistress of the girls' college, because we used to have dances with Nelson Girls College, and storming up and saying, "Can't you turn those things off? Unplug those things." And we've got solid body guitars, and we're saying, "Well, I'm sure Miss Waller could do that, but
you're not going to hear anything." Yeah.
Listen to older voices. The magic of memories. I'm Rob Greaves, and I'm talking with Lindsay Field.
So it was just this standoff that happened over a few years, you know. But we got a few privileges. We got to rehearse in this old prefab theatre at the school, which we could lock and sit in there and smoke cigarettes. And but we got busted for that. We got busted for most things in the end.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, it was great. We had a little four-piece band called The Little People, and three of us were boarders, and drummer, who's John Jeffrey Kennedy, who's an American, wonderful mother, I think was an American, father was a New Zealander, but he went to Waimea College. He didn't go to Nelson College, but somehow we'd teamed up with him. We needed a drummer, yep. And it all worked, and we played together for years, even after we left school.
Okay, so you leave school. What do you do? Do you go to work? What do you do?
I went to university.
So you did go to uni.
I did go to university because I didn't want to have a job. I mean, I did work. You know, I worked as a scrub carter. I worked driving trucks.
Sure.
You work.
But not a career job.
No. And I had no idea what I wanted to do. My brother was a scientist. And so... in a way, I was subtly discouraged from pursuing a career in science because one scientist in the family was enough. And so my thinking process was, all right, I want to retire as early as possible. In order to retire as early as possible, I have to make a lot of money quickly. And how do I do that? I become a businessman.
Oh, okay. That's pretty simple.
So I do a degree in commerce. So I was going to do a Bachelor of Commerce and Administration at Victoria University in Wellington. And, you know, as I said, all you had to do was enrol. You didn't have to jump any hoops.
Yeah.
You just, even if to do medicine, all you did was enrol.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you just went down to Dunedin. There was only a couple of med schools in New Zealand in those days, but no, I wasn't interested in that. And so I went to Victoria University, and that was my first rude awakening, in a sense, because I, you know, as I said, I cruised through school. I didn't have to work. I just got through on general nous. And then when I found myself in lectures with, you know, 200 people who were part-time, you know, working in legal firms or accountants, they were highly motivated, in other words.
Yep.
And I wasn't. And so I very quickly gravitated and I joined a blues band called The Original Sin. I actually took over from a guy called Tony Backhouse, and Tony Backhouse is a very well-known gospel arranger and conductor and what have you in Sydney now these days. And Backhouse he was actually, you know, a music student. He studied music at university. You know, was and still illiterate musically, in that I don't really read very well at all. But I took over from him, became the bass player of this band. We were great, I thought. And we played at all the uni gigs and things around town, you know, just lived that. And, you know, this was just the house that we lived in Kelvin. We had a whole wall of the living room had been painted with the cover of Disraeli Gears, the Cream album, and then another wall was painted with Dennis Hopper roaring out on his motorcycle, and we were chased for years after that by the landlord for damages. But yeah, that was just what you did, yes. You know. It was that wonderful time of
everything was possible.
Yes,
and most things people tried.
Yes, and I remember getting sold my first bag of weed, which turned out to be swamp weed by a dwarf named Stumpy. Oh, God, help me.
Oh, dear.
And it was just rubbish. But by the same token, there was stuff around that wasn't rubbish, and we played at a university ski club gig up in Mount Ruapehu, and that was my first out-of-body experience, where I just found myself sitting on top of the mountain, looking down at myself, sitting in the hole in the snow. Like, life was pretty adventurous, and you know, lots of things going. So I very quickly lost interest in academia.
Yep. And certainly in business commerce.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And so after 2 years, I received a letter from the university telling me that I had been excluded and that I was more than welcome to come back as a mature age student when I was 25 and had probably grown up a little bit.
How did your parents react to all this? Because all the social and the massive music changes that were going on, they were evolutionary for us. They just happened as we were going along. But our parents were being left behind. How did your parents cope with the fact that all of a sudden you weren't going to be in business, you weren't going to actually be at university, and you were following this music trail? Did that worry them?
I don't know if it worried them, but they were very accepting of it. Because I can remember saying to my father that, you know, I aspired to be a garbage collector in Wellington, because you started work at 4 a.m. and you were finished by 11. And the rest of the day was yours, and you were quite well paid for it. And his reaction was, he said, as long as you're happy, if that's what you want to do.
Oh, good for him.
You do that. And at the same time, you know, he had a pretty upright position in the community, being the head of the Boy Scouts, and had this rat-baggy son. But he never tried to force me to be anything that I didn't want to be.
Right.
So in that sense, I was very fortunate to have that supportive environment. I mean, I was going through a lot of trauma. I couldn't, you know, I can remember writing a song when just walking up the beach in the middle of a storm, just kicking rocks, basically, because I just didn't know what the hell I was doing here. You know, well, I was really looking for answers in my life. You know, I really wanted to know what the purpose of life was. What is a human being here to actually do? You know, am I here just to have a career? It didn't seem right to me.
Listen to Older Voices, Ageless Radio.
A process that you couldn't say everybody in the generation went through, but many did question have those sorts of questions. Mm. Obviously, it's those sort of questions aren't really resolvable. We can sort of come to grips with elements, but I think that's the search.
It depends, you know. I mean, it's an evolution. I mean, for me, that evolution continued. I mean, after I finished university, I was driving trucks in Wellington for a company called Coots Brothers and Hare, who were these two wonderful old guys who ran this trucking company, and they were real communists. You know, all their trucks were used in the May Day parade, and it was hilarious because there were about 20 drivers, about 15 of them were Maoris, and a couple of Pākehās, and me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm like this long haired, and we used to drink in the Duke of Edinburgh Hotel, and then that's where we drank when I was at university. We would sing these two other guys and I would sing three-part harmonies stuff all the time in the pub and get, people would buy us jugs of beer. On the other side of the bar from where we were was the public bar where all of these truck drivers, and it was sort of like drank, and it was like a no-go zone.
Yeah.
Except when I started to work there, and then I was
in both.
I could go over both. And we went to the pub after work one day, and one of the young Maori guys said to me, he says, "Hey, you're going to audition for Hair, eh?" And I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "You know, they look here in the paper." He said, "They're holding auditions for Hair." And I, you know, read a little bit about Hair, the musical. And,
yes.
And there it was that afternoon, they were holding auditions in the foyer of the Opera House, just down the road from the pub. And I thought, I'll go. And it said to bring sheet music. So I went to call into the music store, Allen's or whatever it was. And the only piece of music I could find that I knew was Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head. And so I arrived there and it was Jim Sharman was the director and Sandra McKenzie is the assistant director and Patty Mostyn, who's the publicist for Harry Miller, PA to Harry Miller in those days. And so I did this audition. Heard nothing. They said, "No, don't call us, we'll call you." Took all the details. And then I read in the paper that six people had been selected from New Zealand to go and join here in Sydney. And it, because it was already running.
Yeah.
And I'd heard nothing and I thought, well
that's it.
I can go at my best shot. And I was walking up to the university for something. Maybe it was for a gig or something, I can't even remember. And there was a guy there who used to run all of the gigs up at the student union. He said, "Did you audition for Hair?" And I said, "Yeah." And I said, "Why?" And he says, "Because I keep getting, they've had these phone calls from this woman. They're trying to find somebody called Lindsay." So they've lost all of the audition sheets. And all I can remember, there was a guy called Lindsay in Wellington. And, you know, they'd even been doing some, you know, "Will the Real Lindsay Stand Up" on some radio station and stuff.
Wow.
But of course, I didn't listen to radio.
No.
And he said, "You come into my office, ring this number." And I rang, and it was Paddy Mostyn. He says, "Is that Lindsay?" And I go, "Yes." And so that was on a Friday. I went home, packed. Sunday, flew to Auckland, signed my contract for, you know, $60 a week and $30 a week living away from home allowance, and flew to Sydney the next day, which is like a total tangent.
I was going to say, that's really doing it cold, isn't it? I mean,
it's just like, wild, you know. And I was like this pretty naive, relatively speaking, person from New Zealand dropped into the middle of King's Cross, which in those days was, you know, R&R full of Americans.
Oh, yes.
It was
Wild West. It was the Wild West.
Absolutely Wild West, you know.
So you suddenly find yourself, well, not dumped, but dropped into King's Cross and straight into rehearsals, I gather.
Yes. Yeah, there was a bunch of us and we would go to this dance studio and learn the choreography during the day and watch the show at night. And then when we were judged equipped enough, we were sort of integrated.
And whose role did you take?
And at that stage, I was just a member of the tribe.
Okay.
I had a moustache, or what passed for a moustache, and I was starting to understudy Berger.
Okay.
But I was also understudying Claude.
Oh, right, okay.
And the guy playing Claude was a wonderful guy in New Zealand called Wayne Matthews, big, tall, handsome man, beautiful mover, ballet dancer, beautiful singer, you know, he was just gorgeous. We lost him. He was one of the first people in Australia to die of AIDS complications. So it's very sad, and that a lot of people followed him in that sense. And then John Waters took over the role. And then when John Waters left, I took over as Claude. So I was told, when I knew when that was going to happen, because I'd be told to shave my moustache off, which really happened. So,
okay.
And so that was a tumultuous time where everything I'd ever known just went out the window. It was like a whole new beginning in life. Not only was it a new country, it was new everything, a whole...
Yeah. A huge learning curve in many ways, I would have guessed.
Yes. But after 2 years of that, I still ended up in the same place where I was
On that beach?
On that beach. I still wanted, you know, I mean, I'd done the whole hallucinogenic thing where, you know, it's like being in the Perspex elevator on the outside looking in, and yep. I got tired of coming down again. And there was always the risk that you were going to get off on a different floor that you got on, which happened to several people that I knew who thought, well, I don't particularly want to go there. But it wasn't out of fear that I stopped doing that. It was out of frustration, because I thought if that consciousness exists, there has to be a natural way to get there. And so that turned things around. You know, so I was started when we were in New Zealand on the tour. We had an old Austin A40, and we had the eight auspicious emblems of Tibet painted on the bonnet, and the Om Mani Padme Hum mantra on the hubcaps, and we used to embroider our clothes. Yeah. I got quite good at embroidery, actually, and I had, you know, Sanskrit embroidered all down the leg of my jeans and stuff. And so there was that whole, I suppose, quasi-spiritual awakening taking place at that time. But again, I had a sense that I didn't have to go anywhere. I would find what I was looking for.
Next week, in the third and final part of Lindsay's story, it's full of amazing stories, events, and we begin to understand why Lindsay's journey of spiritual and self-discovery is so important to him, and how it's affected the development of his own philosophies. Next week, Lindsay concludes his story on Listen to Older Voices. Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Uniting Victoria Tasmania. The program is funded from the Commonwealth and State Government's Home and Community Care Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.